Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 20th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, a comet that flew too close to the sun, a new protection against the Shiga toxin, and experimental cancer therapies in early stage cancers, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. Hours a day, astronomers are watching the sun, searching for solar flares and observing its undulating magnetic fields. And sometimes they see something completely unexpected, like a bright object hurtling towards the sun. In July 2011, astronomers watched as a so-called sun-grazing comet entered the solar atmosphere and eventually burned up, only 100,000 kilometers from the sun's surface. Dean Pesnell of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center spoke with me about the significance of this observation.
We used the Solar Dynamics Observatory to look at the sun. And one day in July, somebody said they saw a very bright comet going towards the sun. And could we please look and see if we saw it go across the sun? And Carl Shriver went and looked, and lo and behold, he saw this comet go across the face of the sun and completely disappear. So this became the first time we had seen a comet go across the face of the sun. It was the first time we had seen a comet in these kinds of telescopes that we use to study the sun, and it was the first time we had seen a comet literally just evaporate away in front of us. We got excited about that because that was essentially a way to know how big the comet was. As it comes in towards the sun, a big comet will come in, evaporate, make a pretty tail, then go out the other side and swing around for another orbit. A comet that's too small will evaporate long before it gets to the sun. And so this comet was like the perfect size. It came in and it disappeared pretty much at its closest approach to the sun. And that allows us to give a pretty good estimate of the mass just knowing where it disappeared. So all of a sudden we've gone from looking at the sun to looking at comets.
So I imagine that such a demise, being burnt up in the sun's atmosphere, must have been quite spectacular. Can you just describe, you know, the process of how this happened, what it looked like?
As it comes towards the sun, it actually doesn't go inside the sun. It kind of skims along the surface. It's about 100,000 kilometers, which is, you know, several Earth's diameters above the surface of the sun. And it just gets hot, just like you get hot when you walk out in the sun. The comet gets hot. And it's a lot closer to the sun, so it attempts to get even hotter. And it just evaporates away the water that makes up the comet and the dust that makes up the comet, and that all just goes away to make the tail of the comet as it moves through. That evaporation allows it to get very close to the sun. But it's also throwing stuff away. It's getting smaller. Every second that it gets closer to the sun, it gets a little smaller. And the comet we saw in July was just the right size that as it got closer and closer to the sun, it finally just evaporated completely and disappeared.
Now, how long did this whole process take? Once you spotted it, how long before it had disappeared from view?
It took about 20 minutes.
Wow.
So from the time it came on the view of the AIA telescopes on SDO to the time it has disappeared, is 20 to 30 minutes.
Now, this comet belonged to a larger family known as the Kreutz Group. What is significant about this family of comets?
The Kreutz Group of comets is a meteor stream kind of going around the sun. It was a very large comet at one time, and as it went very close to the sun several thousand years ago, it broke up into many small pieces. And now it takes like 800 or 900 years for those comets to go out and come back to the sun. They were first described by a man named Kreutz, who deduced that they may have actually been seen by Aristotle, who may have seen the initial large comet that broke up into many small ones. They were seen again about 1,000 years later, and now we're starting to see them come back around. So we may actually be seeing the larger remnants of the original comet coming back in. They usually see one every couple of days from SOHO. They're usually relatively small, the size of a football field kind of objects, 100 yards or so across, maybe smaller than that.
Wow, how interesting. Now, all of this was seen using the Solar Dynamics Observatory, which is where you work. And so what can you tell me about that observatory? What does it set out to do? What is it watching out in the cosmos?
The Solar Dynamics Observatory was launched in February 2010 and is designed to study the magnetic fields of the sun. So when you look at a typical picture from SDO, they have all these pretty loops and the beautiful swirls and things flying off of the sun and falling back down onto it. And our job is to understand why those loops are bright, where the loops come from. The particular thing I'm interested in is parts of the sun where there aren't any loops. There's nothing there. And that's what I'd like to study. We also use SDO to study the inside of the sun. We have another instrument called the Helioseismic and Magnetic Imager, or HMI, that actually watches waves rippling around on the surface. And by watching those waves carefully, we can actually look inside the sun. And we can see those magnetic fields that we want to study before they get to the surface. So that's kind of our internal microscope on the sun.
And then the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which we mentioned earlier, is actually the one out there spotting comets. What can you tell me about that observatory?
The Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which goes by SOHO, is a joint venture between the European Space Agency and NASA. It was launched in December of 95, and it's been out there taking images since early 1996. And it measured very much the same things that SDO is now measuring. SOHO became so useful to the solar physics community that they designed SDO as an improvement over SOHO. So the measurements are similar, but the instruments had better designs to them, or some more thought went into what we wanted to actually measure, and that's where we got SDO. And the one instrument that we don't have on SDO is called a coronagraph. The LASCO coronagraph flies on SOHO, and basically it looks at the sun and puts a little disc where the sun is. And so it can then take very long exposures of the light around the sun. It sees stars, it sees comets, it actually sees the planets going back and forth by the sun, and it sees material that leaves the sun, and it can see it come towards Earth. And when this stuff leaves the sun, it can come towards the Earth and interfere with our astronauts, interfere with our satellites, and interfere with our power grid.
So this observation of this comet, the comet C2011N3SOHO, if I can use its full name, what did this observation tell us then about the interactions between the sun and the Earth and within the solar system?
Well, the first thing that we noticed was that it was bright. Now, that might be obvious to some people, but to us people that work on this kind of stuff, we would have thought it would be bright when we saw it before it got onto the disk of the sun. But when it got on the disk, it would become dark. And we do see a hint of a dark spot, but in general, when we see the tail of this comet, it's bright. So automatically, we've learned something new about how this material comes off the comet and how it plays around with the magnetic field of the sun. When the AIA sees something bright, it must have many electrons taken off the atoms. It's not just your normal stuff that you sit in a room breathing. It has to be what we call ionized to be seen in AIA. And so we're already learning about the reactions that make this material move into and become part of the solar corona. It's a probe of the shape of the magnetic field. So you send some material in, and as it moves away, it becomes ionized, and it gets kind of stuck on a magnetic field line, and it moves along and illuminates that line. And so we're able to see the magnetic field of the sun much further away than we can normally see with AIA, because there's less material to see, it's not as bright, and so it kind of fades in our telescope. But when this comet goes by, it lights it up and lets us see in very good detail what's going along those magnetic field lines.
So when do you hope to see your next sun-grazing comet?
We've seen one more. We saw one in December called Comet Lovejoy, and that one was cool because it went behind the sun. This one in July, we saw it going across the face of the sun. 6 months later, the Earth has moved around the sun, and it actually showed up on the other side. And this was the first time one of these Kreutz comets was seen by SOHO to come out on the other side.
Well, it sounds like a very active field of science.
We're hoping to make it even more active.
Well, Dean Pesnell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dean Pesnell and colleagues write about a comet's demise in the sun's atmosphere in this week's Science.
Infections with bacteria bearing the Shiga toxin cause over 1 million deaths every year, and no effective treatment is available. But recent observations about how this protein-based toxin interacts with compartments in infected cells have led researchers to a potential treatment, the metal manganese. I spoke with author Shamshuvra Mukhopadhyay about how manganese became a focus of his research and its potential to become an inexpensive treatment.
This work is about finding a possible treatment for Shiga toxin infections. Shiga toxin infections are a major cause of food and waterborne disease in the world. They infect about 150 million people each year and cause over 1 million deaths. What we have found is that treatment of cells and mice with the readily available and inexpensive compound manganese can strongly protect cells and mice against Shiga infections. So what we hope is that treatment with manganese might become a viable option for treating people who are infected with Shiga toxin diseases.
Okay, well, let's get down into what Shiga toxin actually is. How do people get exposed to it, and what happens to them if they are?
So people get exposed to Shiga toxin by food or water. So the toxin is produced by two major types of bacteria, the E. coli and the Shigella bacteria. So E. coli infections are a major cause of foodborne disease in the United States and Europe. In fact, recently there was an outbreak of virulent E. coli infections, which was in the news from Germany, and it was produced by a Shiga toxin-producing strain. The Shigella infections, on the other hand, are more common in developing countries and are responsible for massive waterborne epidemics. Now, what happens with people who get infected with these bacteria is that they first develop gastrointestinal symptoms within a few days. These symptoms include bloody diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, stomach cramps, and mild fever. Most patients who get infected fully recover from the gastrointestinal symptoms within a few days because the body tends to deal with the bacteria and kill them. However, in about 10 to 15% of patients, and this number went up to about 25% in the recent German outbreak, the Shiga toxin, which is released by the bacteria, manages to enter the blood circulation and then affects other organs in the body. So the effects of the Shiga toxin are particularly deadly on the kidney, where the toxin causes a disease called hemolytic uremic syndrome, which causes acute kidney failure and leads to death. So it is this effect of the toxin which is very dangerous, and there is no treatment for this.
So this is a very deadly toxin. And when you say there are no treatments, I mean, different bacteria do respond to antibiotics, but not in this case?
So yes, there is no treatment. And the problem is that treatment with antibiotics is actually contraindicated in this case. Because if you give a patient who's infected with the bacteria antibiotics, the bacteria die and they release more Shiga toxin. And this increases the chances of developing kidney failure and death. So the way patients are treated currently is that when they're infected and they have gastrointestinal symptoms, they are just given hydration. And you essentially hope that they don't succumb to the disease. When patients develop kidney failure, they're treated palliatively and they're given dialysis. And again, you hope that they can recover with their own immune system from the infection. So there is no antidote for the toxin, and the challenge really is to find a way to neutralize the toxin, which is released from the bacteria.
Okay, well, the toxin relies on a pretty complicated mechanism for getting inside cells and actually causing us harm. Can you tell us about that mechanism?
Yeah, so the toxin kills cells by blocking protein synthesis in the cytoplasm, and it has evolved a very intricate pathway to reach the cytoplasm from the cell surface. Once the toxin reaches the cell, it binds a surface receptor, which is a glycolipid called GB3, and cells and tissues which do not express this GB3 receptor are completely resistant to the effects of the Shiga toxin. And it turns out that the kidney expresses a lot of the GB3, therefore the effects of the Shiga toxin are more pronounced on the kidney. After associating with the GB3 at the cell surface, the toxin is internalized to something called the early endosome. And from the early endosome, the toxin has evolved a way to evade degradation in the late endosome or the lysosome compartment, and it directly traffics to the Golgi apparatus. Now, from the Golgi apparatus, the toxin is then transported to the endoplasmic reticulum and subsequently extracted to the cytosol.
In your study, you looked to disrupt this normal, we'll call it normal in this case, trafficking of the toxin using manganese. What made you decide to look at manganese?
So the reason we looked at manganese was that previous work done in our lab back in 2004 had shown that GPP-130, which is a cellular protein that cycles constitutively between endosomes and the Golgi, affected the endosome to Golgi trafficking of Shiga toxin. So the breakthrough for this work began when we were working in collaboration with Dr. Donald Smith at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and we discovered that exposing cells to low levels of manganese caused rapid degradation of this GPP130 protein. Therefore, we were interested in seeing whether manganese, which caused degradation of GPP130, could block sugar toxin trafficking and protect against sugar infections.
Now that you had these two pieces of evidence in hand, that manganese could interfere with trafficking and that the sugar toxin associated with this protein, how did you determine the mechanism for the interaction of all these players?
So what we first examined was if treatment with manganese could block sugar toxin trafficking in cells. What we found in these studies was that when we added manganese to cells, the endosome to Golgi trafficking of the sugar toxin was blocked. So importantly, we also observed that it was not only that the trafficking of the toxin was blocked, but in the manganese-treated cells, the toxin got diverted to lysosomes where it was degraded. Now, this degradation of the toxin is really important from a therapeutic standpoint because it implies that after treatment with manganese, there will not be any residual toxin which will remain in the cell and which can leak into the cytosol over time and essentially cause cell death. Now, in these cell culture studies, we also confirmed that the GPP130 was the target of manganese. And we observed that when we expressed a manganese-insensitive form of GPP130, the trafficking of the toxin to the Golgi was restored. Now, once we had established that treatment with manganese could block trafficking of sugar toxin, we tested if treatment with low doses of manganese could also protect cells against sugar toxin-induced death. Again, these experiments were in cell culture, and we got an amazing 3,800-fold protection of cells treated with manganese against toxin-induced death compared to control cells which were not exposed to manganese.
And you also looked at the effect of this treatment in mice.
Right. So once we got this very strong protection in cells, we took the study a step further and tested if manganese could protect mice against a lethal challenge with sugar toxin. So for this, we first verified that the treatment with manganese by itself did not cause any complications in the mice. And once we obtained a safe dose of manganese, we exposed mice to sugar toxin by itself or manganese plus sugar toxin. And what we observed was that in control mice, which were exposed to the toxin by itself, they died within 3 to 4 days. But mice which were treated with manganese prior to toxin exposure were completely protected against sugar toxicity.
So the manganese neutralized the effect of the toxin in cells and mice, and that's a great result. So what are the next steps for this research?
So we believe that we have taken a small step forward, and there is a lot of work that can be done before we can say that manganese will be effective in the treatment of sugar toxicosis in humans. So the first thing that we have to do is to test if manganese can protect mice which are exposed to virulent sugar toxin producing E. coli. So far, our experiments have been performed using purified sugar toxin, which is the protein itself. And while it is very likely that manganese will also work against the bacteria, it is by no means an absolute certainty. So we are also interested in testing if the combination of manganese with antibiotics can be an effective treatment, because if you remember, I told you that antibiotic therapy is contraindicated in a sugar toxin infections because it releases more toxin. But with manganese, you might be able to block against the effects of the toxin released. So it might enable the use of antibiotics, which would be a big step forward. We also have to optimize the route of administration and the dose of manganese and perform additional toxicity experiments to ensure that exposure to manganese does not cause any long-term complications, because manganese by itself is known to be a neurotoxin at high levels when given for long durations. So these assays will take a few months to a few years, and depending on the results we get, at that stage we will be in a position to begin clinical trials to test if manganese can protect humans against sugar toxicity.
Wow. Well, Shyamshubhra Mukhopadhyay, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
Shyamshubhra Mukhopadhyay and co-author Adam Lindstedt write about the potential of manganese in combating sugar toxin in this week's issue.
Experimental cancer drugs can be dangerous and at times ineffective, which is why those who participate in testing are typically patients with life-threatening cancers. So why is a new wave of experimental drugs being tested in earlier stages of cancer? Newswriter Jennifer Cousin-Frankel spoke with me about the changing perspective of cancer treatment from her office in Philadelphia.
This story is about experimental cancer therapies, new cancer therapies, many of them that have not been approved yet for general use, being tested in patients who have early stage disease. And by that, I think about early stage disease, disease that hasn't metastasized, hasn't spread to distant organs in the body. And in many ways, it's a new way to think about testing cancer therapies, particularly early on in development.
What is the normal protocol for testing untried, unproven therapies?
Well, the normal protocol is, particularly early on when we really haven't tested them in people yet or haven't tested them very much, in cancer, to try them in patients who are very, very sick. So people who have really exhausted all of their options, they have widespread disease in their body, or they have a very poor prognosis for survival. And the reason for that is basically ethics, that, you know, new drugs are risky. We don't know much about them. We don't always know exactly what they're going to do when you put them in a person. And if you're talking about someone whose risk of dying is very high, it's much easier to justify the potential risks of a new drug.
So the difference here basically is that these experimental drugs are usually brought in the late stages, but are, in this case, being brought in the earlier stages of cancers.
That's right. So usually when we're talking about a brand new drug that no one has ever put into a human being, those are really still being tested in people with advanced cancer just because of the risks. But people are starting to think more about, you know, maybe at the next phase of development, trying them in people who don't have a lot of disease, someone who maybe was recently diagnosed with breast cancer. They may have a high risk form of breast cancer, but their disease hasn't really spread or hasn't spread beyond their lymph nodes. People are starting to think more about testing some of these new drugs in patients who might in the past not have been eligible for these clinical trials because the trials would have been limited to people who were a lot sicker than they are.
Right. So what are the risks that experimental therapies can bring to patients?
Well, there's a whole range of risks, and it really depends on the therapy. They can cause organ problems. They could, in theory, kill people faster than someone might die. Then, of course, they also might not work, but that's a different kind of risk.
Well, given all of these risks, what is it that's convincing clinicians to administer these drugs earlier in the process?
I think there are a few different things that people are thinking about. So one is, when you're testing a drug in someone who has really advanced disease, it's really tough for that drug to work, even if it's a great drug, because that person may have tried a number of different therapies, their cancer has been mutating, you know, they're very likely to be resistant to new therapies, and they also just have so much disease in their body that it's hard for a drug to really get rid of it, even a really excellent drug. So, you know, when you test drugs in patients like that, you might see some good responses, and there are some drugs that have worked really well, even in patients who've been very sick. But those patients still are not really being cured of disease. And in general, it's hard to cure metastatic disease, disease that has spread to other organs. On the other hand, a lot of people who now have metastatic disease started with really early disease. So they came in and they were diagnosed with a small tumor and they were treated, and then maybe a few years later their cancer spread. And doctors are thinking, well, it would be really great if we could just prevent people from getting to that place where they have metastatic disease. Let's get them early on. Their cancer hasn't mutated. They have less cancer. The drug's a lot more likely to be effective in them. So that's one theory, that it's more likely to help those patients. Another thing that people are interested in is, particularly with a lot of these new drugs that are targeting molecular features of tumors, we can learn a lot about the drugs and about the cancer by testing them in patients like this. Part of the reason for that is that if you give someone a drug before they've had any surgery to take out the tumor, you can then do surgery just like you would normally and look at the tumor and say, did this drug do what we thought it would do in this tumor? Did it target the right molecule? Did it eliminate the tumor? Is there no tumor to find? And it just gives you a lot of information about the drug that can be harder to get in patients who have advanced disease.
So one question that I have that I think is probably one of the central questions to this entire situation is, how do doctors evaluate what is too risky? What are the factors that they need to calculate before administering these experimental drugs?
Well, it's a really good question, and it's tough, and I think they're still figuring that out. So they're basically looking at two things. They're looking at the risk of the drug, and they're looking at the risk of the disease, you know, how likely that patient is to progress and eventually die of their disease, even if that happens several years later. So the focus here still, even in early stage disease, there are certain subsets of cancers that are more high risk. Patients with, say, lung cancer, even if they have a localized lung cancer, it's more likely to recur. So they're focusing on subsets of cancer that, even if the patient is newly diagnosed, they're still at a higher risk. And then they're also, of course, looking at the drugs and looking at how toxic are these drugs. We may not know all that much, but usually we have some information from testing them in animals and probably testing them in some other patients with more advanced disease. So we have some idea of the risks of the drugs. And thinking about, you know, how risky are these drugs? Does it make sense to give them to these patients? They may also just give them very short term, give a drug for a couple weeks, see what happens, look at the tumor and try and learn from it. They're not necessarily putting patients on these drugs for a very long time at the early stage.
Now, can you give me a few examples of some of these experimental drugs that are being administered today?
Sure. So there are several different trials that are going on with experimental cancer drugs in early stage disease. There's a very large trial right now in breast cancer called I-SPY2 that is testing a number of different therapies. Right now, 4 experimental drugs, and they're recruiting at least 800 women to participate. And these are women who do not have metastatic disease, but they do have a high-risk form of breast cancer, and their breast cancer may have spread to their lymph nodes. So, you know, they don't have just a teeny tiny tumor, but they could be a lot worse off than they are. And in that case, what's being done is giving drugs in this setting of before surgery. You give drugs and you also give a chemotherapy, which is normally done. That's just for a short period of time. Then you take out the tumor and you look and see what the drug did. You see if the drug got rid of the tumor. So that's what's happening in those patients. So it's short term. And the argument is also that if something goes wrong, you can always get in there with more chemotherapy or radiation. Another interesting trial is in lung cancer, where people might be diagnosed with, you know, a small tumor in a lung. And normally in lung cancer, in that setting, the tumor is surgically removed and there isn't really much else that happens because there's not much else that has been found to help those patients. But at the same time, about 40% of them will see a recurrence of their disease and, you know, are likely to die from it. So in that situation, there are a group of doctors who are running a trial where after surgery, they're giving a couple different drugs to patients with early stage lung cancer to see whether they can maybe delay the time to relapse or to recurrence of disease.
Well, both very exciting prospects. Now, given all of these trials going on, what do you think is going to be the result of all of this? Is there going to be a wave of newly approved cancer drugs, do you think?
Well, I mean, a lot of these drugs are being tested in both advanced disease and in early disease right now, so I don't think it's necessarily going to change the number of drugs that are approved or how drugs are being approved. What it may change is the basis on which drugs are approved. So right now, a lot of cancer drugs are approved only for advanced disease. And that means that if you come in and you're looking at an approved drug and you do not have advanced disease, in the U.S., your insurance or the government, if you have Medicare, Medicaid, will not cover that drug. And that makes sense if the drug hasn't been tested in early stage disease. But I think trials like these will give doctors more information about, you know, how do these drugs perform in early stage disease, and could a drug be approved to include patients with early stage disease? Does that mean then we could offer it to patients if it's been shown to help them? But it doesn't mean that the drugs aren't going to be tested in advanced disease too, because they probably will be.
All right. Well, Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel is the author of a news focus this week entitled Experimental Cancer Therapies Move to the Front Line.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us the rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So first up, we have a story about a nano ear. What is that?
This, Sarah, is the world's tiniest ear. And the reason they're called a nano ear is because it's actually made from a microscopic particle of gold that is trapped by a laser beam.
So what makes this little piece of gold an actual ear? How does it detect sound?
Well, the technology is based on something that's known as optical tweezers. And optical tweezers basically use a laser beam that's focused to a point with a lens to grab a hold of tiny particles and move them around. And scientists have been using optical tweezers for decades, actually, to move something as small as DNA around to get it inside of a cell. This new technology, this nano ear, takes off from that because the idea is that if you're holding something really tiny, say a microscopic particle, and instead of moving around, you just hold it there and you wait for other things to move it around, and then you measure how much it's moving. That's sort of kind of what our ears do. They detect these vibrations in the air, and as our eardrums and other parts of our ear move around, we're detecting sound. And so scientists are basically utilizing the same concept here.
So this is really more of a tool for scientists rather than a new way to produce music. What kinds of things are they looking to detect with it?
What they were able to show by creating this nano ear was they were able to detect vibrations or sounds that would be a million times fainter than we could hear, which is pretty amazing. So what produces a sound like that? Well, they're thinking about things like bacteria and viruses, which, believe it or not, actually make sounds when they wiggle around, when they invade cells, when they do other things that maybe are not so pleasant. And the idea would be perhaps someday soon we could actually listen in on these guys doing their thing, and that could potentially lead to new medical advances, could lead to new understandings about how viruses and bacteria do what they do inside of the body.
So the next story is kind of a counterintuitive result. Global warming may be related to winter cooling?
Well, sir, this story is all about why, despite the fact that we know the Earth has been warming since the late 1800s, do we continue to have cold and sometimes extremely cold winters, especially in the Northern Hemisphere? You would expect if the world is warming, then our winters should be more moderate, and yet often they aren't.
Some people anecdotally might say, yeah, last winter was really cold, this winter not so cold, but how did they measure this over time?
Well, what they do, or what they did in this new study, was they combined a lot of climate data and weather data from a variety of sources. And what they were trying to do is trying to get a lock on all the different things that contribute to things like snowfall and lower temperatures and other things that could cause a very extreme winter. And what they found was that there was sort of a Rube Goldberg type thing going on here with the weather, which is probably not surprising because weather is actually pretty complicated. And if I can sort of boil it down, what they found was that strong warming, especially in the Arctic, can cause more melting of sea ice, which you would expect. And the problem is that when you have more ice melting, you have more open water in the Arctic Ocean. That in turn leads to more evaporation, which moisturizes the entire atmosphere. And previous studies have linked warmer than average summer months to increased cloudiness. So now you have more clouds, you have more water in the atmosphere, and this in turn triggers more snowfall in places in the Northern Hemisphere, places like Siberia. And when you have more snow cover in these places, especially when you have snow cover early in the year, like in October, it has a huge effect on climate because snow cover strengthens a semi-permanent high-pressure system that's called the Siberian High. And this reinforces a climate phenomenon called the Arctic Oscillation, which in turn steers frigid air southward to mid-latitude regions throughout the winter. Now, this is all very complicated, but the net result is that when you have warmer weather, it's causing colder winter in various regions in the Northern Hemisphere.
So we've heard a lot about different cycles like El Nino. Does this also kind of add another level of cycling that we need to keep an eye on?
It adds something that we need to keep an eye on. And what the scientists say that is important that comes out of this is it really will help us refine more accurate winter weather forecasts. If we can really take account of all the various factors that come into play when we're talking about snowfall, when we're talking about temperature, then we can more accurately predict how cold, how snowy a given winter is going to be.
In our last story, we have a surprising finding on the origins of diamonds.
Well, Sarah, this story deals with a big mystery about diamonds. And the mystery is, how do diamonds get from deep within the earth, which we know is where they originate, to the earth's surface? And to make this journey, first of all, they have to have some way of migrating up. And they have to actually do this migration very quickly because there's conditions near the Earth's surface that are very violent, and they would basically melt diamonds if the diamonds hung around there for too long. So how are these diamonds getting to the surface of the Earth, and how are they getting there so fast?
So not all this study took place looking at underground phenomenon. They also did some things in the lab.
They did some stuff in the lab. And what they did basically was they tried to replicate as best they could a lot of the material that surrounds diamonds. And it turns out that diamonds are surrounded by molten rock, which can be rich in carbonates, which can give rise to carbon dioxide. And what they did in the lab was they essentially took a salt shaker and they sprinkled a silica-rich material, which is also material that can be found associated with diamonds deep within the earth, and they sprinkled that onto a puddle of molten carbonate-rich rock. This is the type of rock that can surround diamonds. And what they found was that as this mineral dissolved into the puddle over the course of about 20 minutes or so, carbon dioxide vigorously bubbled out, just like if you were to sort of open a can of soda or a bottle of champagne, you all of a sudden have these carbon dioxide bubbles that are basically fizzing all over the place. And what the researchers suspect is something very similar to that is happening deep within the earth, that carbon dioxide is fizzing out of the molten material that surrounds diamonds, not exactly like a rocket, but kind of. It's literally shooting these diamonds up from deep within the earth at speeds of up to 14 kilometers per hour, and it's allowing the diamonds to get through these very violent regions in as little as 3 to 8 hours and end up on the surface of the earth, where they become nice gems that we wear in jewelry and do other things with.
Last up, can you tell us about what was on the news site for the past week?
Right. So, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got stories about a cheaper way to make artemisinin, and this is an important component in a lot of anti-malarial drugs. Also a story about how snakes sense the heartbeat of their prey and know when to stop squeezing. For Science Insider, we've got a story about a Russian team that's drilling in Lake Vostok, which is in the center of the Antarctic continent, and how they've almost reached the lake. This is an endeavor that's been going on for a long, long time, and the researchers may be finally close to getting there. Also a story about teaching climate change in schools, how educators are finding the challenges very similar to those about teaching evolution. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is, surprisingly enough, about doing science in Antarctica. And our chat next week is about the science of anti-aging research, the challenges and the promises of trying to keep our aging in check. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Okay, thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the January 20th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.